Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman produces this show. We're here till 1 o'clock, Monday through Friday. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's also 12:09. We frequently visit with Michael Miller. He's an associate professor of economics at DePaul. Mike, welcome back to WGN.
Great to be with you, John.
Can we start with some of the executive orders? Sometimes these things have teeth, sometimes they don't. What did you notice about the orders that President Biden signed yesterday?
Well, he extended the moratorium on people being evicted, and now that'll certainly help those who have lost their jobs and unable to have money then to move to a new place or whatever. And he's also done something with regard to student loans. The payment moratorium is on, so students don't have to pay that, or former students don't have to pay that anymore.
Yeah.
But he also took one action, which I guess was not surprising. He nixed the Keystone Pipeline, which was between the United States and Canada, a way of moving some of the heavier oil up in Canada down to the refineries in the Gulf states and so forth. And because of environmental concerns and so forth, he decided to get rid of that. So we'll have to get our oil elsewhere, and certainly Canada is not very happy about this decision. And so there's some good, there's some bad.
Which is which? What's the advisability of those three things?
Well, certainly the Keystone, until we have renewables that truly can replace the things like oil, I think we need to make sure that we can have oil which is supplied by people we can trust, and at reasonable prices, so that households can heat their house and drive their cars with reasonable oil prices and so forth. And I think this just makes it a little bit harder. Certainly with the people who are in trouble, who are unable to pay their student loans and their mortgages or their rents, I think the government, which was behind many of the problems we're having right now by demanding things shut down, I think this is probably a very targeted way of helping people who are in trouble.
I like the idea of forbearance until September. I don't know, maybe earlier, maybe later. But if the economy isn't back and people still don't have cash to pay off their loans, they're not saying those loans go away. They're saying you just don't have to pay until the fall. There's also a conversation about should we discount the amount they do by up to $10,000. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, that's going to be a really tough one because those loans still have to be paid. It's not that the debt doesn't disappear. Otherwise, the one that, of course, has to absorb all the costs is the one who made the loan in the first place. And this could reduce the amount of lending that would go on if people always fear that somebody will be able to walk away from their responsibilities. So the government would have to be very careful to make sure that the people who would receive such a benefit that there is no other alternative, and they couldn't just do this as a blanket decision.
Well, that's what they've been doing. The government has shown that where they're interested in maybe helping people, they're not very good at targeting it. You wonder if maybe they'll have time to craft something that will discount the amount owed to the people that really need it. I don't know how you define that, but some people seem to be pretty whole and some people aren't.
Yeah, see, that's one of the rough things. I was just looking at a study that came out. It's a working paper from the NBER, and it mentions that when it comes to forbearance, the people who were, in a sense, helped the most in terms of numbers, they were people on the bottom who really could use the help. But when you look at it in terms of actual dollars that are in forbearance, because people who are in higher incomes who maybe lost their job would have much more higher rents and higher mortgages and so forth, about 60% of the benefit has gone to people in the upper half of the income distribution and only 40% to the people on the bottom. But the number on the bottom is quite substantial. So in some sense, at least we've targeted in terms of the numbers of people, if not the dollars.
Michael, is everything still about the vaccine? As goes the vaccine, so will the economy?
I think that is the what is driving it right now has been the same thing as driving it before, and that is that state governments and local governments are closing down businesses, and that hurts employment, stability, and so forth. And the second thing is that people are still afraid to either travel or to resume normal behavior in terms of shopping and dining and vacations and so forth. I'm still hoping, and almost all the forecasts I've seen of very reasonable people, including the Fed, show that by mid-year that a lot of these vaccines will have taken hold, that people will feel more secure, and that we could have a very, very good second half of 2021 with a very average first half of 2021.
That's what our average first half. So where we are now, not so good, but July forward, much better. One more question.
That's what they're saying.
One more question for you. So
sure.
Democrats throughout Washington, Senate, House, and the executive branch maybe means more taxes. Do you have any thoughts about the possibility of higher taxes on individual earnings, corporate earnings, et cetera, and what does that mean?
Well, certainly the president is asking for an increase in the top rate for the biggest wage earners and for Social Security for those making over more than $400,000. He's trying to raise the corporate tax. He needs to be careful, though. More than a little research is out there that shows when a government raises taxes, it is extremely what we would call contractionary. There's something called the multiplier that means that when you tax $1, you actually reduce the GDP by more than that. The research coming out shows that such actions, such increases in taxes, mm-hmm. especially when the economy is in a situation like it is now, could be very stifling. It could actually partially derail the recovery from this pandemic.
Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics at DePaul University. It's always good to talk to you, Michael. Thanks for your time today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, John.
Ian Schur is the editor-at-large at CNET. Visit CNET.com. Hi, Ian. Welcome back.
How you doing?
I'm doing really well. I'm going to ask you the same sort of question I asked Michael Miller from DePaul a moment ago. The president yesterday signed some executive orders. He's got his own bag of policies he wants to initiate. In the tech world, what does a new administration mean?
Primarily, it's going to be a conversation around antitrust, which I think is going to be really fascinating. One of the things, you know, we've learned over the last few years, Democrats and Republicans don't basically agree on very many things, but they both agree on the fact that tech needs to be reined in and that new regulations need to be put in place. And so it's very likely that we're going to see a continuation of pressure on the tech industry from the Biden administration, including on things like the Communications Decency Act, which is what gives tech companies legal immunity from anything that people post on their websites. President Trump wanted a certain part of that to go away. President Biden's very much of a similar mind. So we're likely to see a bunch of pushing back on the tech industry in the next couple of years.
President wanted to go away because it was punishing him. Why does Biden want it to go away?
A lot of it comes down to the fact that there is a perception that the tech industry is not doing its job. So, you know, President Trump had a misunderstanding, it seemed, of what Section 230 did. He thought by removing it, it would force the tech companies to allow him to say whatever he wanted.
Right.
In fact, it would probably do the opposite of that. Tech companies would probably actually lock down even harder because they don't want to be sued by people who, you know, who get angry at what is posted on their websites. So what the Biden administration wants is that they want to basically force the tech companies to do a better job moderating their platforms. There's a pervasive belief in Washington, D.C., and it's growing across the country, that tech industry's failure to moderate their platforms has allowed this new threat of domestic terror to really kind of fester. And so that you look at stuff like the conversation around QAnon, right, the conspiracy theory, or around even going back to Pizzagate and, the Stop the Steal. All of these things together are connected, unfortunately, to misinformation campaigns online that Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube allowed to go on.
So did that section, what did that do relative to that? I thought that it granted them immunity from prosecution, right? They would not be held responsible for some of the crazy things that were posted, correct?
Exactly. So if I were to post something bad about you, which I never would, but if I did, you couldn't sue Facebook, but you could sue me and, you know, in court, right, for slander, libel, whatever. And it's those types of things that the companies, you know, that freedom from worrying about being prosecuted really has allowed the tech industry to grow into what it is today, you know, basically without mm-hmm. any regulation. And there's this belief that that needs to change because these companies are making, you know, oodles of profits off of what's really a lot of human suffering at this point.
But that's going to shut down a lot of speech then, isn't it? Because they would probably then, if they thought they were liable, err on the conservative side of closing down things that weren't necessarily inciting riots, but maybe just made them uncomfortable, and then they pull that too. Is that the direction we want them to go?
That's the line we all have to learn how to walk, is that as, you know, if it was just as easy as removing those protections, then the government would have already have done it. The reality is that the government is trying to figure out ways to incentivize tech companies mm-hmm. to do the right thing without just, you know, kind of cutting, you know, doing the hammer and nail thing, right? And I think that that's going to be, you know, if you say, well, you lose your protections if you don't meaningfully moderate your platform, then the companies are going to be forced to moderate their platforms better, right? And it's those types of things that the government's trying to figure out instead of just merely kind of doing a big swad swipe and possibly ruining it all.
When Janet Jackson's breast was exposed on the Super Bowl, radio and TV stations across the country went into a hyper-vigilant mode. They mm-hmm. began to tape shows and then broadcast them lest something bad get out. Even on the radio airwaves, I don't know if there's an analogy here, but it was the fear of getting fined or shut down that got religion big time in the broadcast industry.
Yeah, and look, I think that what's interesting is that if you think about that analogy, and I've actually brought it up when I've written about this on CNET, you look at the attack that happened in Christchurch, right? That guy who went on a rampage and killed some 50 people mm-hmm. in New Zealand and did it online. You know, literally he had a live streaming video with him. That is something that Facebook allowed to publish online and last for over an hour before they took it down. And if you follow that same belief, right, that, you know, having some protections in place instead of allowing people to just have complete and utter access to the entire world at any moment, then you start thinking about, okay, well, how could we have stopped that awfulness from spreading on the internet? Because it wasn't just that hour. It ended up spreading across the entire internet, and it became such a huge problem on YouTube and Twitter and everywhere else.
So the application of that would be, well, anybody can FaceTime or a broadcast to the world video, but now you might have to go through some sort of channel, some sort of editor. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there's also another thing that I've argued, which is maybe that Facebook and Twitter and YouTube need to have monitoring systems in place that say, hey, if something's getting a ton of attention, let's take a look at it, right? So they still allow things to happen, but they're much more aggressive about looking at things that suddenly become really popular. It's those types of things. It's very basic kind of moderation ideas that they just haven't implemented, and it doesn't make much sense to me why they haven't.
Ian, is this true? I heard that, and I don't know how you calculate this, but the amount of misinformation on the internet plummeted when former President Trump lost his Twitter account.
Yeah, this was rather amazing. So it comes from a organization called Signal Labs with a Z. And what they did is that they actually study a lot of this stuff. And there's a lot of actually methodology behind it. The Anti-Defamation League, which is an anti-hate group, they have been actually studying this stuff as well for over 30 years. So there's a lot of science behind this. And what was really interesting was, as you point out, in the, you know, in that couple of weeks, suddenly we saw the amount of misinformation fall significantly. And it also is worth noting that a lot of QAnon accounts were also banned from Twitter at the same time. So it's not just President Trump. But I think it underscores one of the things we learned during the 2016 election, which was that the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, in their research, found that a lot of the awfulness, particularly anti-Semitic attacks on journalists online, were coming from a very small number of people. But it was getting amplified so much that it seemed like it was coming from millions of people, when in fact it was only coming from a couple thousand. So if you shut those people down, suddenly a whole part of awfulness on Twitter would have gone away. And it's that kind of thing we're starting to see now.
Netflix subscribers soar past the 200 million member number. I didn't think that they revealed many of their numbers. Netflix is telling us how many subscribers they have, huh?
Yeah, Netflix actually has been sharing that data for quite a while. And what I think is really interesting is that it underscores how much people have been turning to entertainment, obviously, during the pandemic. That seems like an obvious answer. But I think what's interesting is there's so many streaming services now, right? There's Disney Plus, there's HBO Max, there's Hulu, which is also owned by Disney. There's CBS All Access and Paramount and all these things. And deciding which one you want, you know, at one point, I think people are going to get sick and tired of paying $8 to $15 to every single person. So instead, at some point, they're going to decide which ones they want. And Netflix, obviously, is doing really well. Disney, as well, has done way better than they ever expected they would, partially because the Star Wars TV show Mandalorian did so well. And I'm really curious to see whether HBO is going to also be able to compete in that, whether Paramount's going to be able to compete, Peacock, all these other ones. There's going to be a shakeout, a lot of executives have told me, in the industry at some point, because they figure people only want to pay for like 4 subscriptions or so. There are way more than many than that in the actual world. So I'm curious to see how it plays out.
We kept our subscription as long as Game of Thrones was on and then lost it at some point thereafter. Maybe hit shows drive that. We, for some reason, are watching the Peacock streaming service right now. They have a show called Escape to the Chateau, which is about a couple from England that buy a chateau in France and fix it up. It's a fixer-up show. I can't stop watching it. There's like 60 episodes, and I don't know if I'm going to end up having to pay for this, but I would for this show. It's that good.
I mean, I would like to escape to a chateau myself. So.
but you might not this one, and yet you might. So that's the drive of the show. It's Ian Schur, the editor at large from CNET.com. We'll talk again. Thanks, Ian.
Absolutely. Take care.
12:35. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. I'm John Williams. This is the story of a couple of young men who dropped out of college to pursue a business dream from Chicago. And they're going to be on Shark Tank tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. We'll see how they do on that show. But the story is of a couple of guys, one of whom has diabetes, and so he can't eat any carbs. He's enjoying an omelet and thought, well, the crispy leftovers of an omelet are almost like a chip. I wonder if we could make an egg-based chip that I could enjoy. Now, does the Shark Tank bite? Here's Nick Hamburger, the co-founder of Quavos.com. Nick, you're on WGN. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be here, John.
Is that the setup? I mean, is that sort of the genesis of your product?
Yeah, you told the story as well as I can. Basically, just those crispy remnants when you cook an egg were Zach's favorite part of an egg, and he always cooked eggs as a low-carb snack for his diabetic lifestyle, and it all came from there.
That's Zach Schreier, your partner. So are you guys from Chicago, or were you just going to school? What's your Chicago area connection?
Yeah. No, we've lived in the suburbs our whole lives. And then I was at college at the University of Chicago.
I see. So that's a pretty good business think tank there. And yet you drop out of the U of C?
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because we got our start at a business contest at U Chicago at the Booth Business School. And after we won that, we just kind of got obsessed and dropped out from there. So because of the programming run at the business school, we ended up leaving school.
Kind of broke your parents' heart, I suppose. I know it's an expensive school, but U of C is usually the passport to a successful life. Don't pursue your wacky chip idea, right?
Yeah, you know, thankfully our parents have been very supportive of us taking time off, but I can always go back if I need to, but I've certainly been enjoying running the business instead.
So do you have a product? And talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So we created the world's first ever egg white-based chip. It's super high in protein, super low in carbs, and we've been selling for just over 2 years. We're in about 1,000 stores around the country, and most notably for Chicago folks would be Whole Foods in Illinois. And then we also do actually most of our sales on Amazon.
Quavos, Q-U-E-V-O-S, Quavos is the name of the chip, right?
Exactly, and a lot of people ask us where that came from. Basically, it's a combination of quick and huevos, because they're quick huevos. You know, eggs you can eat on the go.
Well, so what does it taste like? Does it taste like a chip or an egg, or do you flavor it?
Yeah, so they kind of taste like whatever we flavor them as. So it's a pretty bland base chip, and then we add, you know, we've got honey mustard, sweet barbecue, cheddar, dill pickle, lots of different flavors. So the flavor really comes through, and you do not get the sense that they taste like eggs. And then, you know, we call them chips, but honestly, they're somewhere between a cracker and a chip. They're very light and very crispy.
High protein, low carb, gluten-free chips made from egg whites. Are they healthy or just not unhealthy?
No, they're actually really healthy. I think the easiest thing to compare it to is almost a protein bar or a health bar, because we've got 8 grams of protein, 4 grams of fiber, and only 4 net carbs. So kind of a nutritional panel that's not really been seen before in the chip category.
Yeah, listen to you, nutritional panel. So was that, I'll bet you had a learning curve, right? I mean, I'm making a food that will be mass-produced and consumed around the country. It has to be safe. I have to know my stuff, right? I mean, that must have been an intimidating venture.
Yeah, it's definitely been a lot to learn in a very short time period. And, you know, we've just kind of dove in, and we've gathered a team of really good advisors as well. So we've learned a lot, but we've also leaned on our mentors and advisors where we don't have experience.
Well, how do you produce it? I mean, so I can understand what the remnants of an egg looks like in a skillet, but then how do you make thousands of chips consistently and so forth?
Yeah, it took us 2 years to formulate the recipe and also find the right kind of high scale production process. So we have a bit of a unique and proprietary process that I can't go into, but it was a journey to discover how to do it, and it's so unique that we actually have to manufacture ourselves. We haven't been able to find a manufacturer that has all the right equipment. So
you do that in Chicago? Does that happen around here?
Yeah, it's on the south side, about 10 minutes south of downtown.
Is the business profitable?
You know, we still are not. We project to be by the end of 2021. So we've raised some funding from local angel investors and VCs.
What are you talking about there? Boy, we talk about that every week. We have a segment where we talk about the sort of local tech you know, money that was raised. Is that something you can share?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I hadn't shared this sort of info much beforehand, but it's all going to be in the episode tomorrow. So now I'm much more comfortable sharing, because 4 million people will hear it tomorrow. So we have raised just over $2 million from angel investors and VC firms. Most notably, Kraft Heinz put in a little bit of money because we were in their incubator program.
Wow. Okay, we got to go, and you're on TV tomorrow night. I know you can't tell us how it goes, but then did you do the presentation, or did your colleague Zach, or both of you? And I guess the panel of judges tasted the chips, is that right?
Yeah, both Zach and I were there, and all the sharks got to try. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun to watch. Hope people can tune in tomorrow night on ABC.
Yeah, and I mean, the proof's in the pudding, right? If they like it, you're in, and if they don't like it, you're out. Is it that simple a sort of decision point?
Yeah, I think they have to love the product, and especially with food. No one wants to invest in something they don't enjoy eating. But then they ask all the fundamental questions and see if it's a business they're interested in.
Did they make fun of your last name?
You know, I didn't actually get too much grief for that. So
his name is Nick Hamburger, and his partner is Zach Schreier, and a couple of Chicago guys on Shark Tank tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Maybe we'll catch up with you again later this week or next, but congratulations already. Whole Foods ain't bad, and I hope it goes well for you tomorrow night.
Thank you, John.
Good luck, Nick.
It's a pleasure to be on.
You betcha. Quavos, Q-U-E-V-O-S, Quavos.com. 12:43, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Suburban office vacancy is nearing a record high. Cranes reports the vacancy rate rose to 25.2% in the fourth quarter, up from 25% in the third quarter. The data from Jones Lang LaSalle shows current available space is just shy of the 25.4% peak reached in 2010. With companies still unsure when employees will return to the office, no one can predict the pandemic's long-term toll on the suburban office market. United Airlines has posted its fourth straight quarter of losses. United says it lost nearly $2 billion in the fourth quarter, and operating revenue fell to $3.4 billion compared to nearly $11 billion a year ago. The airline says it expects first quarter 2021 revenue to be down more than 65%, but that an accelerated distribution of the COVID vaccine could lead to a faster improvement. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
So, Amy, there you are. So what's Amazon going to do? How are they helping the new administration on that?
So what Amazon's done is, that, as you said, they've sent a letter pledging their support, but they also point out that Amazon employs a lot of people. It's one of the biggest employers in the country. And so not only are they offering to use their vast infrastructure to help reach that goal of 100 million Americans getting vaccinated, but they also are in it because they want their workers vaccinated. Earlier in the pandemic cycle, we heard about major outbreaks happening at, particularly at Amazon shipping centers, a lot of employees testing positive and things like that. So, you know, part of that is Amazon wants to get their workers covered, but they also recognize they have a really large infrastructure available where they've been ringing cities, including Chicago, with a lot of distribution sites. They have a lot of ability to move vaccination doses from place to place, so they're willing to help in any way they can. Now, there are some concerns about, you know, of course, you can't just throw doses on an Amazon truck. You know, they have to be refrigerated and frozen in some cases, but I think, you know, Amazon offering up that infrastructure is pretty significant, and hopefully will make a difference.
That's kind of been the running joke around here. Just get Portillo's or Amazon or somebody that's already doing a good job distributing things to distribute the vaccine. We already have the infrastructure in the private sector.
Right, right. You know, if it didn't have to be kept so cold, I think it would be much easier. But, you know, that, of course, is a big, big part of it.
And in Chicago, of course, and this is true for other cities as well, it's not a distribution problem, it's an acquisition problem. We actually have to get to scale. If we could get a million doses out a day, I don't know that we have a million doses available every day right now, do we?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the big question, is getting up to scale. You know, we saw President Biden call upon the Defense Protection Act, which means ramping up supplies in all areas to combat this. But the other part of that is that people have to be willing to take it. We can have all the vaccines in the world, but if people aren't sure about it, you know, there was some kind of questions about its safety. So there's also a lot of campaigns that are going to start rolling out. The city health leaders, Dr. Allison Arwady, as well as the mayor, have both kind of talked about that, of the importance of letting people know that it's safe, letting people know that, you know, you are going to need both vaccines. You might feel a little bit, you know, under the weather for a couple days after getting that first one or the second one, but that's normal and to be expected. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot more of those campaigns to let people know that it is safe and effective, and you know, trying to help even give medical providers and give people, you know, their regular doctors some talking points of how to explain to people that even though it's new, it is safe to take.
1B starts Monday in Chicago. That includes teachers. Allison Arwady got her second vaccine today. And yet Janice Jackson, the CPS CEO, told us a little while ago that some teachers don't want the vaccine. I just don't understand that, Amy.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of eyes are on CTU right now. There's a lot of tension brewing between CPS and the Chicago Teachers Union as they're trying to come to an agreement about the reopening plans. And there's been a lot of teachers that have kind of anecdotally been saying, hey, I was looking for a medical accommodation where I don't need to go back to the building. I'm not getting that. But we have this Monday deadline where some students are supposed to come back, and then another one on February 1st where K-8 is supposed to come back. So we have a lot of tension and just days to resolve it. So I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about teachers, because they really want that written plan that, that both the district and the teachers union can agree on, this is the protocol and this is how we're going to proceed safely.
Don't blame Amazon for saying we'll help. And by the way, why don't you help? You scratch our arm, we'll scratch yours. Let's talk about United Airlines. What is their projection for getting back to pre-pandemic profits?
Yeah, you know, it's looking slightly rosier than it had. Some airlines over the summer had started putting out some pretty grim outlooks, saying, you know, it's going to be 2025 before we're back to that 2019 level. Well, United, and their earnings call happened today when we're looking at those quarterly earnings, but they put out some language yesterday talking about, you know, we actually think that we're going to exceed pre-virus margins by 2023. Now, part of that could be kind of pent-up demand, but part of that, they're saying, we've made some very big and permanent cuts. We've re-engineered how the team works, and we think we're going to be a more efficient corporation on the other side of this when travel does pick up, and that can help us capitalize on that pent-up interest in travel. I mean, it all remains to be seen. You know, we have to just wait and see what happens and how it shakes out. But, you know, I think they're counting on what summer bookings are going to start looking like, which those are tickets that people are going to start buying sooner than later. I know personally in my inbox, I've started getting emails from airlines saying, you know, book now for summer. We'll see if people respond to that. I think probably a lot of people are kind of in a wait and see mode just to make sure that everything's on track with vaccines and travel restrictions and things like that. But we'll see. But it's interesting to see a hint of optimism, if you can even call it that. But optimism in such a strange way, but optimism nonetheless right now from airlines. It's just been so grim. Now, that said, because they're looking further down the road than just this summer, they're still aware that there are some really tough months ahead for the virus, for different parts of the world being impacted in different ways. But that long-term view they've taken, the runway has shortened a bit, which I think is really, really compelling and will be something to watch very closely.
I think optimism is the right word. Peter Greenberg was talking last weekend on his Eye on Travel show. You'll hear it this Saturday afternoon if it's on its regular time. But he said airlines are seeing this now. You'll see it reflected in prices. They know people are going to start traveling again this summer. If you want to get a good price on a ticket, you better start planning on getting that ticket because there's going to be pent-up demand.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's kind of what the airlines are counting on, coupled with, and I think they're hoping that'll get them through the interim, but coupled with, hey, during this time we had to make a lot of hard choices, but we're hoping they make us better going forward to be a leaner operation. That said, the CEO of United, he said, you know, United will be changed forever because of COVID. It will always be a different airline, which is another telling remark, but really, really interesting to see little tiny glimmers of hope coming in from airlines. Delta had about 65% down, United reporting about 70% down, but still, that's, you know, it was 90 at one point, so Optimism nonetheless.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch, always following the airline business. Thanks, Amy. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, John.